Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Board of Health. Please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Consent agenda, is there a motion to approve the minutes of July 25th, 2018?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. Motion carried. Comments from the public? Okay. Very good. Public health and action.
So this has been a pretty active summer in terms of swim beach safety. So we're going to have Alyssa Payne and Logan Dearborn are going to come up here. And
Morning.
Present about some of what we've been doing around swim beach safety.
Thank you.
We're back.
Yeah.
Okay. Can I ask a quick question? So is it up or down? Down. Okay. The opposite of what I think. Got it. So good morning, counselors. My name is Alyssa Payne, and I'm an environmental health specialist helping oversee our seasonal swim beach program. With me is Logan Dearborn, our summer swim beach intern. And this morning, we're going to be talking about our swim beach program and all the work that we've done this summer. So, in public health, we seek to protect the health of residents and visitors by ensuring a safe and healthy environment. We do this in the swim beach program to protect the public from the risk of disease that can occur while swimming in our natural bodies of water. Logan is now going to be talking about where and what we monitor for.
We sample at the three designated swim beaches here in Clark County, which are Klein Line Pond, Vancouver Lake, and Battleground Lake. We routinely sample for E. coli every other week between Memorial Day and Labor Day weekend. We sample for cyanotoxins whenever cyanobacteria bloom is present, occurring in any natural body of water within the county. We report all drownings that occur in natural bodies of water to the Washington State Department of Health. We sample and monitor other surface waters as needed based on complaints or reports. Now Alyssa will give more details about sampling for cyanobacteria.
As Logan mentioned, we will sample for cyanobacterial toxins when a bloom is present. If we receive a report that about a possible bloom, we'll send a staff member out to verify that a bloom is present. If it is present, we will post the Lakehead caution, and you can see this sign on the slide, and we will collect a sample to test for cyanotoxins at the scummiest part of the bloom. An example of that can be seen in the photo, which was taken this last July at the Vancouver Lake Flushing Channel. We sample for toxins, antitoxin A, microcystin, and cylindrospermopsin. We alert our PIO to issue a press release and post updates on our social media, and we post all updates on our website as well. We'll also work with park staff to have these signs posted at the Flushing Channel and the swim beach. We will post the water body at warning when the bloom is visible, and we have received results indicating that cyanotoxins are above our allowed threshold values. When this occurs, we issue an updated press release and work with parks to update our signage. We could close the water body if toxins were elevated and the bloom was present in an area easily accessed by the public, such as the swim beach. We would inform our PIO to inform our PIO and parks to ensure that notification via press releases, signage, social media, and alerting individuals with the park reservation to ensure that all are aware of the closure. On this slide, you can see Washington State Department of Health's decisions tree for cyanobacteria sampling and advisories, which we follow. As long as a bloom is present, we conduct weekly samples of the scummiest parts of the bloom to ensure that the bloom is below the threshold levels of cyanobacteria toxins. We send the samples to the King County Environmental Lab. Sample analysis paid for by the Department of Ecology. Clark County Public Health is responsible for shipping those samples, which has cost $105 thus far, and the hours it takes for the monitoring and the samples, which has been approximately 42 staff hours thus far this year. I'll now hand it off to Logan to talk about our E. coli monitoring.
Excuse me, the Battleground Lake, when we post that, is that posted before? Out at the entrance so you don't pay to get through the...
I believe so. We do work with park staff, and we usually have them determine where the signs are posted.
Well, hopefully they would, so you wouldn't pay to get in and discover the place is closed. So
yeah, we usually leave signage up to the park staff to post because they are actually the stewards of those parks. They know the common access areas where people are going to be accessing the water, and so we usually leave signage up to them. I know that at Vancouver Lake, whenever we've done an advisory for cyanobacteria, they'll actually hand out leaflets with the sign, so that way people have that information. And then usually, I don't know if people then decide to turn around after getting that leaflet.
Okay.
I would hope parks would allow them to do that.
And I like your term, scummiest. That's a cool term.
Is it a scientific term?
It is. Okay. Wow. Okay.
As stated before, we do biweekly sampling for E. coli at Clanline Pond, Vancouver Lake, and Battleground Lake. Using the EPA's beach program, we have adopted their beach action value of 236 colony-forming units per 100 milliliters of water to ensure that the beaches are safe to swim in. If one of our samples exceeds this value, we'll post the lake at warning and contact our public information officer as well as the Parks Department to issue a press release, update our website, and get the correct signage posted. We will resample until all samples are below this beach action value. Extra samples can be pulled at the event, after an event at the discretion of the leadership team or the health officer. If two or more samples exceed the beach action value, we will close the beach. We will again contact the public information officer as well as the Parks Department to coordinate public notification through press release, social media updates, as well as updates to our website. One of my projects this summer was creating an E. coli flowchart that will be used as a tool for making enforcement decisions. The flowchart uses the number of samples that exceed the beach action value to ease the decision-making process. Clark County Public Health samples Clanline Pond biweekly, and these samples are paid for by the Parks Department. Clark County Public Health pays for the investigative samples, which are any of the samples outside of our routine sampling cycle, and that has totaled to be $2,475 so far this year at Clanline. Clark County Public Health also pays for the staff time, which has totaled approximately 50 hours so far. Alyssa will now cover how we conduct outbreak investigations associated with recreating in natural bodies of water.
Okay, so as Councillor Bolt, we did have an incident at Battleground Lake this year. Another part of the Swim Beach program is responding to outbreaks associated with recreating in our natural bodies of water. We're going to go through the recent outbreak at Battleground Lake and explain the process for responding to and mitigating an outbreak. And so first, let's define what a waterborne illness outbreak is. So we declare an outbreak when there are two or more epidemiologically linked persons experience a similar illness after exposure to the same water source, or epidemiologic evidence implicates the water as a likely source of illness. This occurred at Battleground Lake this year, but also in August of 1999, we had E. coli 0157H7 in Battleground Lake. In July of 2012, there was Shigella in Clanline Pond. In August of 2014, there was Shigella in Clanline Pond. And then in August of 2014, there was viral gastrointestinal illness associated with Louisville Park. Logan will now be discussing the timeline for the Battleground Lake outbreak.
In the case of this investigation, our communicable disease, or CD team, was notified through routine surveillance of reportable pathogens, which Shigella is one, on July 20th. CD will then interview those who are affected by the illness to identify the possible source of disease. During the Battleground Lake investigation, we learned that they swam at the lake on the 14th and saw fecal matter in the water through an interview with the mother of the ill individuals. When CD determines the suspected source is the cause, they will contact EPH staff to implement control measures. CD will then notify the health officer to coordinate issuing a health alert and media release. Environmental Public Health issued a warning at Battleground Lake and collected samples to be tested for E. coli on July 20th.
On July 21st, Clark County Public Health received the results for the samples taken on the 20th. All were below our threshold level. The warning was left in effect, though, until another round of samples could be collected showing that they were below our threshold values. On July 23rd, we pulled another round of samples to test for E. coli. On the 24th, Clark County Public Health received a notification from Multnomah County reporting three cases of Shigella, with individuals reporting at swimming at Battleground Lake on July 14th. which was the same day as the other cases. No other common exposures between the two groups was identified. On the 26th, we received the results for the samples taken on the 23rd. All were below our threshold value. The advisory was lifted, and we worked with our state, parks, and PIO to issue a press release. And from then till now, our CD team has been working with our Oregon partners to wrap up the investigation. On this slide,
I have a question. If we could go back to that prior slide, please.
Yes.
So July 24th, we get a report from Multnomah County. So were these Multnomah County residents that were swimming in the lake?
Correct.
I see. Thank you. And they could give you the dates that the people swam and all that so that you could connect it.
Yeah, so the same process that we went through with our Clark County residents, Multnomah County went through with their residents and saw, that's why we work with Dr. Melnick to issue a health alert. So that way providers are like, oh, you have Shigella. Our partners know that Shigella is attributed to Battleground Lake, and we're able to see that common swimming date and forward that information to us.
That communication system is crucial.
Yes, agreed. So on this side, you can see an EpiCurve our CD team created that shows the swim date as July 14th, with all individuals reporting illness starting on the 16th, which is an incubation period consistent with Shigella. You can see that we are notified on the 20th, and the only cases that occurred after that date were secondary cases. And so those are people that did not become ill with swimming in Battleground Lake, but they became ill from being around individuals that got ill from being in Battleground Lake on the 14th. So we call those secondary cases. And so in total, 11 cases were associated with Battleground Lake, 6 primary and 7 secondary. Genetic testing of the Shigella showed strains were similar, which suggests a common source. Swimming in Battleground Lake is the leading hypothesis for this outbreak due to individuals reporting seeing a fecal incident in the water. We had 2 unrelated groups with lab-confirmed Shigella reported swimming in Battleground Lake on the same day, and we have had illnesses associated with recreating in our natural bodies of water before, such as the Klein Lime Pond Shigella outbreak in 2012. Investigative samples related to Battleground Lake outbreak were paid by Clark County Public Health, totaling $550, and staff hours, which include our communicable disease team and environmental public health staff, totaled approximately 45 hours, but their investigation is not done yet, so more hours could still be attributed to this outbreak.
If that's a state park, why doesn't the state pay that?
I don't know that we have any mechanisms to charge the state.
We ran this world.
And we also pay for the investigative samples at Klein Lime Pond in Vancouver Lake. So I'm not sure, like Alan said, there's a funding mechanism for that. But we just tend to pay for the investigative samples for when we have illnesses or kind of other issues that we need to investigate.
Might be something we look into.
It's a really good point. So we brought this up. This is one of the foundational public health services that we provide. And we got some money from the legislature last year for this. That whole system is underfunded, and the state hasn't provided that kind of money. We're going to have another ask with the legislature this coming, and we'll be keeping you informed because we'll need your support on this to ask for funding for foundational public health services to just cover this stuff. There's no way we can't do this because public safety is at risk, but the system is not funded.
But the state gets $10 for going in their park. So I think we should do something.
That's one of the reasons we brought this to you, because not only the importance of the work we're doing, but the fact, you know, you raise the questions that we've been raising, you know, how do we pay for all this? And the state should... Yeah. Could be providing funding for this. I agree.
Okay. Sorry.
So now I'm going to hand it off to Logan so he can talk about the research that he's been doing this summer.
Currently, I'm a student at the University of Washington who's majoring in environmental health and minoring in chemistry, music, and microbiology. I am also creating a research project on the factors that lead to higher E. coli counts in swim beaches, and will be presenting this data at the School of Public Health Research Symposium in the spring. Using the data taken from Kleinlein Pond, I have made a few connections between the behaviors that cause increased levels of E. coli. Initially, I tried to find a connection between the pond's water temperature and increased E. coli counts. Unfortunately, I found no relationship between these variables. I later tried daily high air temperatures, which correlated on most days, but did not consider factors that included pond closures and pond warnings. Finally, I looked into number of transactions, which lined up with the temperature data and also considered when people were not using the park. In this graph, both daily high air temperature and transactions for the month of July are plotted. July 23rd is the first date of our warning at Kleinlein Pond and is the only place where the graph deviates from its overall trend where transactions line up with the daily high temperature. Increased temperatures demonstrate an increase in transactions and thus allows me to use number of transactions as my X variable in the rest of my research. In this graph, the X-axis is the number of transactions, while the Y is the plate counts of E. coli. Individual areas within Kleinlein Pond Swim Beach are plotted in different colors. The dots on the graph demonstrate the individual counts of E. coli in relation to the number of transactions, while the lines depict the overall trend for each location within Kleinlein Pond. Overall, all of the trends depict that as transactions increase, the plate counts of E. coli increase likewise. However, this did not occur in all sample locations equally, with the lines that saw higher plate counts typically fit the trend better. Our first data point above the threshold was converted to 236, which is our beach action value, in order to make the graph easier to read. And now to summarize the data. The daily high temperature has a direct correlation to the number of transactions, a measure of use that considers beach warnings and closures and other behaviors of recreators. However, this is used only as a proxy for bather load. Not necessarily those who are all entering the swim beach because it is a count of the people who pay to park their car. This does not include people who walk or bike into the park because they do not have to pay this fee, or those who hold an annual pass are also not considered. Increased number of transactions had higher plate counts of E. coli. As transactions increase, all values also increase in relation to the number of transactions. Using this data, we can conclude that increased E. coli counts can be attributed to higher bather load and is not due to other factors, including animals on the beach, because Vancouver Lake has many more waterfowl that roost on the swim beach than compared to Kleinlein Pond, water temperature because there was no relationship between the variables, or air temperature because it's not the only force that is driving human actions.
So it's the people's fault. It's the bathers.
It's the bathers.
And so I'm, you know, I noticed the various locations. I'm wondering if the highest count was in the most shallow part of the of Kleinlein Park.
So here you explain.
So our three highest are Kleinlein 77, 78, and 79. 77 is the one directly in the middle across from the bathroom, while 78 is the one across from the splash pad. So we were looking into seeing if there was a correlation between splash pad use and then use of that specific part of the beach driving children closer to there. Yeah. But unfortunately, a lot of those dates we did not sample on, so we couldn't test the hypothesis.
Yeah. I'm wondering if it would be helpful, and maybe it's already there, signs directing parents about feces in diapers that they really need.
I'm so glad you brought that up. So, as Logan stated, there is a correlation between the number of people visiting Kleinlein and the elevated levels of E. coli. With this, we are going to be working with our PIO, Marissa Armstrong, to make 1 month this upcoming spring focused on swim safety. During this campaign, which will include press releases and regular postings on our social media, we're going to be covering topics such as educating parents about swim diapers and reminding them that children who aren't potty trained should not be in non-chlorinated water, while also reminding parents to take their kids on frequent restroom breaks every hour, along with other healthy swimming behaviors. We're also going to be partnering with our Green Neighbors program during this campaign to remind people to take responsibility for their own water quality by providing them resources on how to implement natural gardening techniques for their own lawn to help reduce the amount of fertilizers entering our waterways, which can attribute to cyanobacteria blooms. We're also going to be working with park staff to provide them education to give to parents on swim diapers, along with having them install diaper changing stations inside the restrooms.
Can we make sure that those are asked, that the parks install those on both the men's and the women's side? Because so many times they're only on the one side. As a dad, please. Thank you.
Yes, it is. Klineline is unique in that they do have a splash pad spray feature, and that is a permitted water recreation facility. And so as a permitted water recreation facility, you are required to have facilities available for individuals that want to use that. And diaper changing stations are one. And so we're going to be ensuring that they're both in the men's and the women's restroom as required.
That's good.
And then that was our presentation. Did you guys have any other questions?
I have a couple of questions, which don't completely relate to the E. coli, but, well, or the disease in water or bacteria. First, I saw one of the dates that there was something found in Louisville Park.
That was back in 2014.
14. Mm-hmm.
And that was, so viral gastrointestinal illness, so it was a couple cases of norovirus associated with swimming in Louisville Park.
So it would have been, I mean, moving water seems like it.
It was in the kind of more shallow area, okay. And it was a very ill child that should have not been.
Oh, I see. Okay. So, okay. Yeah. And then the other thing I was curious about is you say that you report drownings. Do you have any of that information, where they drowned? And I know you may not have come prepared for that, but I was curious.
We can get that information to you.
Okay.
Us and King County are the only two jurisdictions that are reporting drownings occurring in natural bodies of water to the State Department of Health, and they use that data to create policy.
Okay.
And so I know we've had...
We've had one, and it was at Paradise Point earlier in the season, mid-June.
Okay.
And so when we do report those drownings, we include general information, what we can get from news articles, their age, their gender, mm-hmm. the activities that they were doing.
Do you go to the medical examiner? Because I know we get reports from the medical examiner when somebody dies like that.
We did reach out to a police department at one time to get additional information, and they did not seem apt to provide that because it was still an active investigation.
I see.
And so we talked with the State Department of Health and asked if the information that we were providing was enough, and they said that it was enough because we were one of the few jurisdictions actually doing it.
Okay. The medical examiner is not the police, so you might be able to get more information from him, mm-hmm. them.
I will look into that. Thank you.
Okay.
Do we do anything with Lacrimus Lake or Round Lake?
We don't. We do monitor them.
We monitor them, though.
Yeah, so if we receive complaints, like we did receive a report that someone had seen a bloom at Lacrimus Lake and Round Lake, so that was a fun day for Logan.
Oh, yeah.
There was no bloom.
Oh, this is a nice hike.
Yeah.
I guess.
But we don't routinely monitor them like we do the other water bodies that we do, because right. they don't have a designated swimming area, like Battleground Lake, Klineline Pond in Vancouver Lake. So they don't have that kind of sandy, sloped area and that encourages bathers.
Well, we have issued warnings, I believe, and we had a dog die of cyanobacteria contact. And
right.
That was Lacrimus Lake. It was a few years ago, I believe.
I do have a lot of
people. We've also had one at Vancouver Lake.
Also, so your information about temperature and everything is very interesting. Can we take that, everybody has a pool, you know, this year in their backyard, general information about, you know, about what you've learned in lakes and maybe educational for pools, you know, if it's warm, really hot, you know. I know our pool's green, you know, when it's hot, so, you know.
Yeah, pools are always just going to have an easier time
because right. yeah.
it's chlorinated. Right. But even we tell our pool operators, like, for example, like, I don't know if you guys have ever been to a spa, and they have, like, that bather load sign on the side. Not a suggestion. That's a requirement. So usually if a pool operator sees too many bathers in the water, they'll tell them to get out, or they'll test the water because your bather load will depleash the amount of chlorine that you have. And we have a requirement for the amount of chlorine present. So if you have too many bathers and not enough chlorine, you got to close the pool.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good job. The director's report, health officer resolution.
So the next item on the agenda, and there was a staff report as well, is a resolution about alternate health officers for Clark County. And this is this resolution is about a backup for me when I'm out of town. And in the past, the way it's worked is we've actually the Board of Health has passed resolution in the past. In the past, naming specific health officers, but health officers come and go. And we spoke with the prosecuting attorney. It seemed like the best way to go would be to have more of a kind of a generic resolution so we could get a qualified health officer in place without restricting it to two or three people. So the way this resolution works is that if I'm going to be going out of town on vacation or something, as a primary health officer, I can appoint somebody, or the county manager can appoint somebody, or the chair of the Board of Health can. And if the chair of the Board of Health is not around, if I'm reading this correctly, and the prosecuting attorney will make sure that I'm doing this correctly, if the chair of the council of the Board of Health is not around, one of the other council members or Board of Health members can appoint an alternative health officer. Generally, it's going to be me because I'm going to see who's available to cover. And the way it works is that the person who's covering has to be a qualified, has to meet the state RCW qualifications in terms of being a health officer. So that's who we'd be appointing, or the county manager would be appointing, or you would be appointing. It'll make it a lot easier to get coverage when I'm out of town.
So if you just, you know, disappear off the face of the earth and you don't have this information, is there a list that we can call, or?
There's certainly a list of health officers in the state. Oh, generally, it's a health officer from one of the other counties. Like I'm covering for Lewis and Thurston right now because our health officer is gone. And actually, that health officer, Dr. Wood, is somebody you've named in the past as covering.
Okay.
But this would allow me to identify other folks as well who could cover. But it would generally be somebody who's a health officer somewhere else in the state.
And explain briefly, what would be the most critical kind of issues they would face? And if we had an earthquake or something, and you're gone, and public health gets energized, what kinds of decisions would they make?
That's a great question. The alternate health officer would be making the same kind of decisions that I make. They would have the same. They would be the health officer, so they'd have, according to the RCWs and the WACs, have the same obligations. Most of the times, it's things around communicable disease control, whether it be an earthquake or something else. It's issues around that. There could be issues around environment. You know, like we're just talking now, environmental exposures and, you know, posting things to prevent environmental exposures. But generally, those are the things that come up the most in terms of what the health officer is involved with.
And would like a standard operating procedure for substituting for a public health officer in another county be, is it understood that they would be consulting with the top-ranking staff in our health department?
Yes, that's. I'm sorry.
To get a context locally.
Yes, and you know one of my obligations when I leave town is to basically fill them in on how things. I mean, kind of like a sign off. So generally, when we cover for each other, I wouldn't say generally, virtually all the time, when we cover for each other, we basically sign in and sign out to each other and say, this is going on. You know, be prepared for this or be prepared for that. So that's. I mean, it's not in the resolution, but that's. It's kind of like how physicians sign in and out for each other.
Standard practice.
Yes. And I wouldn't want to walk into it. I would not be happy covering for somebody if there was some big deal going on and they didn't tell me about it ahead of time and I just walked into that. So it works out well for all of us to keep each other informed. And the other nice thing about this is the more we do it for each other, the more we learn our fellow staff and how it all works.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Yeah. Question. So in looking at this, I was kind of wondering, who do you have a list of physicians or something? That these would be other health officers that have, or maybe people who have served as health officers, or are they existing health officers generally?
Most of the folks that I'd be using would be existing health officers, and the way, and I would recommend that, because the way it works is that we have a system to contact them through their local health jurisdictions and their system. They're not just retired folks that are kind of hard to find.
Right. Yeah.
They're engaged. And there's a list. I mean, I have my preferences, but there's a list of folks, of health officers who are, I would recommend using health officers who are already working as health officers.
Okay. And are they normally nearby? I mean, are they close counties, or is that a rule? Or is it a rule? Is that kind of what you use?
That's a really great question. Historically, I've used people who are nearby. So I've used Cowlitz, Lewis, and Thurston about as far away. The bottom line, though, is like virtually all of it is by phone. In fact, when I go to a state medical association meeting and I'm outside of Clark County, I don't turn the coverage over. I have a phone and I can do that, and I can come back if necessary. So it can be done by distance pretty easily. And actually, by doing it this way, and I'm hoping other jurisdictions do it this way, we can have a more robust health officer coverage network that makes it easy for all of us. Because some of the counties have a little bit more difficult time getting health officer coverage.
Okay, so one final question. The previous historical resolution, it named a person or persons?
It named three, if I remember correctly. Actually, I left one county out, Mason County, we cross cover as well. So if I remember correctly, I think it was 2014, it was Dr. Wood, who is Lewis County at the time. Now she's also Thurston. It was Dr. Yu, who is Thurston at the time. She's now Mason. She was Thurston and Mason. She's now Mason. And it was Dr. Vines, who is Cowlitz County Health Officer. So I think those were the three that were named, and those are the folks I use the most. This will also enable me to use our deputy health officer, Dr. Everson, who does some work for us and for Skamania. She's also a health officer in Yakima, so this would allow us to do it without naming her by name.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Inside shop. Our wonderful attorney, this has been noticed. It's okay to vote on? Okay. Very good. Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that we approve Health Officer Resolution Number 2018-08-22.
Second?
I second it.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carried. Thank you. Okay, back to school.
Thank you, Chair Volt. The reason we're bringing this up is that, well, obviously it's back to school season, and you may have seen some stuff in the news. We've had a couple of measles cases in the area. There's actually another measles case that was a secondary case to that first one that occurred in Oregon, and that's being investigated. And there may be Clark County contacts that we'll be looking at. We don't know yet. We're in the midst of the investigation. The thing that concerns me, and the reason why we wanted to just get it out there and have this talked about here at the Board of Health, is that we have Clark County has a higher exemption rate from school required immunization. So a number of immunizations are required for attendance in school. And so they're required, but there's three ways to get exempt from getting the vaccinations. One way is to have a medical contraindication. So, for example, if you've got, if you're on cancer chemotherapy or you have an immunosuppressive disorder, you can't get a live vaccine like the measles vaccine, for example. There's a religious exemption. So if your religion prohibits you from getting your child vaccinated, that's another exemption. And then the third exemption is a personal exemption, or I like to call it a philosophic exemption. If you're just basically opposed to vaccination for whatever reason, you can get a personal exemption. And the vast majority of exemptions are are for personal philosophical reasons. So I'll give you an example. In kindergartners in Clark County, and we're looking at the last, the 2017-18 a year, because obviously school year hasn't started yet, 7.9% of kindergartners in Clark County had exemptions.
Countywide?
I'm sorry.
This is countywide?
Countywide for kindergarten in 2017-18. 7.9% of kindergartners had exemptions. Of the 7.9, 6.3 of those were personal, philosophical. Only 1.2% were medical, because that's pretty rare, and 0.3% were religious exemptions. So the vast majority of exemptions for K through 12 last year countywide, it was 7.5% exemptions. And those 5.9, so the vast majority were for philosophic reasons. Washington passed a law a few years ago that basically said if you had a philosophic exemption, you had to get a note from your healthcare provider. So it's made a little bit more difficult. But the problem is that the exemption rate varies from school to school and area of the county to area of the county. And if you look at all the immunizations, the number of kids that were complete for all immunizations, so they may have met the basic requirement because they were up to date, but in terms of being complete, for the 2017 or 2018 year, the percent complete for all immunizations was below 80%. It was 77.6% in Clark County. And compared to the rest of the state, we're lower. So, for example, we were at 77.64%. King was at 88.75%. Snohomish was at about 89.11%. And Spokane was at 88.43%. So we're lower than Cowlitz and Skamania and Wakayakum in terms of our immunization rates. The thing that keeps me up at night when we're having for measles is that for things like measles, which is a deadly disease, and the mortality rate from measles is 1 to 2 per 1,000, and there's been a number of deaths in Europe where they have even higher exemption rate. I wouldn't call them exemption rates, but a higher percentage of folks are unimmunized. With measles, it's exquisitely contagious. So if you have measles and you're with a susceptible population, each case of measles can lead to 12 to 18 other cases. And each of those 12 to 18 other cases can lead to 12 to 18 cases. And actually, measles is contagious before you develop the classic symptoms. So 4 days before the rash, you don't know you have measles, but you can be, you're contagious for it. It's exquisitely contagious. The virus stays in the room, in the air in a room, 2 hours after the person with the virus has left the room. So when we're investigating these cases, you can imagine, in terms of doing the contact investigation and notifying people who might have been exposed and our concerns about them, it can lead to a lot of work as well as risk for the public. So,
So when you have a kid at school and you get 1,000 pieces of paper to fill out, one is for vaccinations. So when they say to prove for your vaccinations, do they also send out or fill one of these exemption sheets out?
So I think what happens for the parents, if their child is out of compliance with the school requirements, the parents have to state their reason, whether it be religious.
They have to sign?
I believe the parents have to sign it, but if it's a philosophic exemption, they have to get a note from their healthcare provider basically saying that they had the conversation.
Personal. Not if it's personal.
Yeah, that is personal.
The personal one, they have to get a note saying, they have to sign that they had a conversation with their physician, with their healthcare provider.
They sign it, not the physician?
That's a good question. I'll have to get, the physician signs it.
Oh, really?
But, I mean, it could, it, I mean, there are a number of physicians, and I believe it can be a naturopathic physician as well who signs it. So you can find somebody to sign those for you.
Todd. Okay.
As I recall, quite a few years ago, this whole issue of immunization came about because of a theory that autism was stronger in those children who had immunization. And you see reports on both sides, but probably more reports that it actually doesn't cause that. But I'm assuming that this is kind of where some of that philosophical...
There's a variety of reasons, and if you look on the anti-vaccination websites and all that, by the way, that autism study, that was Andrew Wakefield. The study was discredited. Lancet, the journal, had to retract the study. He basically lost his medical license for that. And there's been countless studies. I mean, the medical literature is filled with it. I've looked at a relationship between immunizations and autism, and that has been repeatedly and over again debunked. But you're absolutely correct. There's information out there. There are still folks who believe. There's a lot of myths going on. We did an interview with City of Vancouver TV, and we've got some stuff on. We've done a number of public messaging around this, including our Facebook page, to try to debunk some of these myths. But on social media, there's a lot of, and I've used the word nonsense. There's a lot of nonsense out there. There are a lot of really smart people who still believe in this, but. Vaccine safety, I mean, the number of adverse reactions is less than 1 in 1 million. It's one of the safest things we do. These childhood vaccines don't have mercury in them, but you still read people saying that there's mercury in them. And even the mercury that used to be in some of the vaccines is, at levels that, there's no human toxicity about, but there's just a lot of misinformation out there. And now we're seeing what bothers me is that, measles used to cause, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of cases in the U.S. every year with many deaths. I mean, it's a potentially fatal disease. And we know what whooping cough can do, especially to infants. The basic solution to this to protect everybody, and especially the kids who can't be immunized, or the people who can't be immunized because of immunosuppression or chemotherapy, is for the rest of us to get immunized so we have herd immunity, which means that if enough of the population is vaccinated, you can stop something from progressing and protect the vulnerable around us. With measles, it's kind of scary because we have some schools in Clark County, and you can actually go on the state website and look at immunization rates by school, that are well below the threshold for herd immunity. The only thing we can do when there's an outbreak in a school is we have the authority to exclude children who are at risk, but that's after the outbreak we recognize it's already begun. So it kind of keeps me up. There are some schools that have fairly high immunization rates. Exemption rates.
If I sign a exemption, is that confidential? Only the school can...
Well, the school would have that information.
Can you have that information?
On a per-student basis is what you're saying? On a per-student basis?
I'm just wondering. So, yeah, is that... Is there some way where you could send out information to these people and say, hey... Sometime it may be helpful to keep looking at this and get your kid vaccinated.
We can get information on the exemption rates for the school. I mean, we don't go to each school and say who's there, who's not immunized. We can get immunization rates on exemption rates on the school. If we do have an outbreak at a school, so if we do have a measles case at a school, we will work with the school to actually identify and exclude kids who might be susceptible to measles. So then we would be working with the school to identify folks and making sure they were not only excluded, but that if they were exposed, we were following them and we were taking appropriate precautions to make sure that they don't infect other folks down the road. That might mean not only excluding them, but actually keeping them at home during the period where they could develop, become contagious. That's why there's a ton of work that goes into this. So we identify, if we have a measles outbreak in a school and we identify some kids who might have been exposed that are unimmunized, they have to be watched and isolated at times for up to 21 days, you know, quarantined for up to 21 days to make sure they're not in a place where they can infect somebody else. That's an incredible amount of work.
You know, we have the school task force that we set on. Mm-hmm. This might be an issue. We have all the superintendents in the same room around the desk. We bring this up, one of the agenda items we talk about.
I think if the health department knew the percent, you know the percentage of these kids that are not vaccinated, I think it would be good for your department to offer to do an education piece for the parents. Have a PTA meeting where you explain some of this and you know, these parents who maybe are fearful could get better information so that they would change. I know that takes hours for you, but it is a public health issue.
It is an incredible public health issue, and that why I keep bringing this to you is that that's one of the foundational public health services. One of the things when we're advocating for more funding from the legislature for this is that the immunization rates are, the exemption rates are scary, and we really need to be able to have the resources to do exactly what you're doing, to work with the schools and get the appropriate information out to people on this.
Which way are those immunization rates trending? Are we seeing more people? Are the exemption rates going up generally year to year? Are they flat? Are they going down?
That's a really good question, and just off the top of my head, I think they've been tending to go up, but I can get that information from you. And I don't see any of my colleagues have that information.
Maybe just a few pure numbers. How many kids that?
The difficulty is that there's, it varies by school.
Right.
It varies by district and varies by school, which makes it very difficult. So in terms of whether it's going up or down, it really depends on where you're at.
So I want to make a point that the family does have authority to decide for their own children. And it worries me a little bit that the tone of the conversation we're having here is that anybody who is an intelligent person, educated, and chooses not to have their child have all vaccinations, certain of these are critical. And we start this with infants. So, on the whole, for the community as a whole, vaccinations can help reduce outbreaks, sickness, and death. But the family does have the authority, and I believe the family has a right to privacy. So that I want to defend that. I also want to make an observation about some possible reasons why people are being less inclined, only slightly less inclined to vaccinate children. On television, every day, there are massive numbers of ads that are, these childhood vaccinations aren't enough. These are all pharmaceutical company ads. And pharmaceutical companies have a place and an important role in our country. But we're hearing more and more, whatever vaccinations your child has had so far, it's not enough. You need more. And now we need teenage vaccinations. And then we need boosters and we need this. And I think the public is getting a little overwhelmed about how much chemicals we put into ourselves to protect our life and the lives of our children while we're trying to find chicken that's organic. So I think what we're getting is a little bit of an overload about that.
So I would, for anything medical, I would never recommend, I agree with you, I'd never recommend looking at advertisements. And I can go on and on about direct-to-consumer pharmaceutical. But what we recommend is that people talk to their physician about what they're and actually the recommended vaccine schedule, it's going to change because the science changes over time. And you may have been alluding to the HPV vaccine, which actually does prevent cancer. But the immunization schedule that we're recommending is incredibly safe and is necessary in terms of preventing illness. But I agree with you. I'm not happy about, you know, direct advertising around this stuff. Our recommendation is to talk with us, to talk with your physician and your child's physician about what vaccinations are necessary.
And my point is non-medical, ordinary people, us regular folks, are seeing that on TV and going, well, what's this? More and more. So that's good advice. Talk to the physician and public health to get the most factual information.
And that's why Councilor Quiring was mentioning, you know, more outreach in terms of with parents in the schools. I think that's the potential. I mean, there's information overload that's coming out to folks right now, and a lot of it is really bad information. So, unfortunately, I mean, social media has created challenges as well as opportunities, but getting the resources to actually get the correct information out to people in this area of information overload would be really helpful. So.
And what I'm just a comment on Councillor Stewart's cautionary things with the privacy. I completely agree that this is the parent's prerogative to be able to do this. But I think if you allow for this information to come from a health office source, it has more authority. And you avail to those parents. And this would be the whole body. It's not going to be just the parents that exempt. It's going to be everybody because we can't really know who the parents that are exempting are. But as a resource for them to be able to actually find out the real information and not social media things and that kind of.
Yeah, we want to provide parents with the tools so they can make an informed decision that is based on science and the best way to protect their kids. Around the privacy issue, we don't get, and I'm not interested in who's got an exemption at a school. Right. And we don't go, unless if we have an outbreak, we need to have information because we have to protect everybody in that school, including, you know, all the kids in the school. So that's when it gets to that point, but we do respect privacy.
Right, agreed. I would say absolutely you need it then because you have to chase it down, but otherwise.
Okay. Anything else?
I think I covered everything, and I think your comments helped cover everything as well, so thank you.
Anything from the board? I just, for your crew, talking to the food booths at the fair, you guys did an excellent community service, you know, it's kind of, so did a good job.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, okay, thank you for coming. Meeting adjourned.